Introduced Ed and Mark, Ed and me, and Mark. You all know the members of the George Jackson Brigade, and I'll get into the specifics of that and what that was all about. They've dedicated their lives in fighting for social justice and revolutionary change and struggle. They both spent a significant amount of time in prison, and they're both political prisoners. And when Mark was in prison, I believe you helped found the Black Panther Party chapter in Walla Walla when you were in prison. And since they've been out, they've continued their struggle, and they're both very active. And so, without further ado, Mark and Ed.
Okay, I'm Mark Copeland. Before and after, the before was I was just a common person. I didn't have any political activism at all within me. I just couldn't see anything. I'd been in prison a couple times, but the second time I went, that's when we kind of politicized. That was about 1967. That's when I became aware of the founding of the Black Panther Party. And that was founded due to conditions that existed then, horrendous conditions that don't exist today. They still exist in a different form. But we took direct action, kind of an intense action by setting up a model. You've seen around here, I passed around the Panther Party 10-point program. That was the model that was set up that we were to go by in order to try and correct the conditions in our community. And racism was so strong that the black community, people felt safe in the black community. And we decided to make the community ours and make it progressive. And that was what the Panther Party was trying to do. Other communities, the Barrio, Brown Berets, followed the model of the Black Panther Party and did the same there. And these models were picked up by others to try and help their communities. It kind of upset the government that we were taking it in our own hands to try and help our communities. And so they started bringing in programs about that time to undermine the credibility of those groups that were going on. This is, in a sense, before. This is 1967. Like I say, I was in prison at the time. And so I started, myself and my captain, Clement Blanchey, started a Black Panther Party in the Walla Walla State Penitentiary. And that was my first real insight into political activism inside a prison. And it went much beyond that. We figured out a way to actually take over a certain part of the prison and create a positive program where prisoners worked. It's the only time prisoners worked, had their own business, and paid themselves. The highest paid prisoners in the United States at that time because of the program we set up. And we worked out of the prison industries, and became the only shop within the industries that made money. All the others were losing at that time. But this wasn't due just to myself. It was due to other people who became influenced by the activism that was going on outside of prison. And that grew. It grew across all cultures. And after doing time, I came to Seattle. That was about 1972, and set up a program, an above program, ground program called the Convention 72. This was to encourage and enhance and get support for prisoner labor and prisoners' right to vote, etc. Again, it was a long time ago, and things have changed since then. Prisoners have been getting the right to vote slowly. Not prisoners, but ex-prisoners, where they never had it before. But what I'm trying to say is that the little things we did then really count for what's happening today. And we were looked as terrorists, whether the Panther Party or the Brigade or the SDS, the Weather Underground, AIM. Looking back at them now, we call them terrorists. But we were the ones who gave the impetus to keep things going, which brought about what is happening today, 40 years later. And yeah, kind of keep this in mind that you can't separate them. You can't look, put this in a pocket and say, well, that's just part of history that had nothing to do with reality, what's happening today. That's not the way it goes. You have to struggle, constantly struggle and struggle and bring things up. And that's what we're doing today. And it's the reason I'm here, is trying to encourage you to find models that you can involve yourselves in order to help correct some of the things that are going wrong in our communities and our nation today. But I want to, I'm just talking about the creation of my activism. Like I said, after I got out, I met some people in the George Jackson Brigade. And I'm not going to get too deep in that, because that's going to be Ed's story. But I was influenced by what they were doing. And the first people in the brigade that I knew were, in a sense, expelled. Some of them were expelled. And a new unit of the brigade was created. And I was able to help develop that second brigade, or that new unit of the brigade. And I want Ed to go ahead and take it from here. Where he, how he came in, his history, is before and afters. Oh, well, before he gets into it, I'll tell you about my after. I'm an investigator. I work with investigations in the Defender Association downtown. That's in downtown Seattle. That is an agency that helps people who cannot afford prisoners, and I mean, not prisoners, attorneys. And we supply attorneys, investigators, and paralegals to help those people. I also helped found another organization called OWL. It's a union, conglomeration or association of unions. And we were able to help some of the people up here in Olympia who were the anti-war demonstrators. We spent some money to help you with your defense. But anyways, that's who I am now. Okay. Ed, you want to go with it?
Okay. First, I'm going to browbeat you with politics before I talk more about the brigade. And anybody who would like more information on the brigade, is there's a George Jackson Brigade Information Project, gjbip.org, and you can check out that website. There's a lot of documents, news clippings from the era, and we'll tell you more about the brigade and what it did. Have any of you ever read messages or communiques, or whatever you call them, by Osama bin Laden? Okay. Do any of you remember the two conditions that he set out for there to be peace? Those conditions were, firstly, stop killing us. Secondly, remove your bases from our lands. Pretty simple, pretty easy to achieve. And the alternative is, he said that their first objective would be to destroy us economically. How much the current crisis has to do with any of that, with these wars that are going on, is speculation. But we certainly are having some bad economic times. My second question, how many of you are all hopped up on post-election euphoria? Okay, well. I'm here to pop your bubble. Obama voted to renew the Patriot Act. He's voted to continue to fund the Iraq War. He backed the FISA, electronic surveillance legislation that allows the government to listen to your phone calls and read your emails and such without warrants. His willingness to be a lackey for Israel goes without saying. Supports the death penalty. Refuses to champion single-payer, non-for-profit health care. Isn't willing to reduce the defense budget. And he supported this huge swindle of taxpayers called the bailout. But it's going to take time. I mean, there's nothing I can say or that anybody's going to say. But the fact of the matter is, regardless of how progressive you are and how good-hearted you are, when you're elected to office, whether it changes you, you don't change the office. Liberal Governor Jerry was elected. Jerry Brown was elected to. He's a radical from back in the day. Was elected to be the governor of California. He was worse than Ronald Reagan when it came to human rights. It just, and today he's Attorney General of California. So, it was a historic election. It was a humongous event that Obama got elected, and it will mean a great deal in race relations in this country. That is so important, and I don't want to understate that. Just as it was important for Nelson Mandela to be the president of South Africa back when the Botha regime capitulated to the demands of the African National Congress. Today there's a revolutionary movement in South Africa against the African National Congress, because all that they've done is put a black face on white capitalism in South Africa. South Africa is still selling weapons materials to Israel. Nothing fundamental has changed. The real change that has to come about has to be revolutionary change. It will require a radical transformation in existing class relations. And anything short of that is, and there's nothing wrong with liberals. I mean, that's, you know, some of my best friends are liberals. But if you're really looking to make some change, then understand that it isn't going to come about through the electoral process. Salvador Allende in Chile in 1971 he's a socialist, and he was elected to the presidency. And his military, Pinochet, overthrew him, killed him, shot him. And the Constitution of the United States was written by rich white men, property owners, for the interests of property owners. And there's no way within the context of that Constitution are you going to be able to redistribute or take that property. I mean, it just, you know, you can't do it. But, you know, that state must be smashed and replaced with a state that represents the interests of the ruling class. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to talk about what is American exceptionalism. And George Jetson. There's a green pamphlet over here that's got an introduction to it that the publisher wouldn't print because he disagrees with politics. And so the copies of the pamphlet that I distribute, I include the preface that he wouldn't print. And the essence of the introduction of American exceptionalism is, while people in other parts of the world are fighting and dying in a just struggle against international imperialism, we here in the belly of the beast enjoy a special privilege of limiting our feeble protest to only lawful means, acceptable to the bourgeoisie. This is nothing short of American exceptionalism, a racist belief that our lives are more precious than those of our darker-skinned comrades in places like Palestine, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Iraq. History demands more of us. And so that was the politics of the brigade, is that if the people in Vietnam and elsewhere around the world are fighting and dying in an effort to get U.S. imperialism out of their nations, and if we are in solidarity with them, and that solidarity means more than just walking around in circles carrying some kind of sign, and I'm sure that if if you've been activists for any length of time, you've seen the millions of people around the world who opposed the Iraq War and marched with their signs, and I was one of them. I was living in San Francisco at the time, and we would have 100,000 people, and or more, maybe 200. I don't know. Lots of people would come to these demonstrations, but every demonstration there would be fewer people and fewer people and fewer people, as you know, that marching in circles, carrying the sign, just wasn't going to get the job done. But the leadership never got that memo, and continue to this day doing the same ineffective stuff. So American exceptionalism was the foundation of the politics of the brigade. That if people are fighting and dying around the world, that we need to be taking some risks as well here. And that's not to say that everybody should be doing that kind of work. There's all kinds of work that has to be done. And for those of us who felt that when the time comes, the means to fight, the means to survive the hunt, isn't going to just fall from the sky like manna. It has to be built. And it has to be built with trial and error, with mistakes made, with sacrifices. People, Mark served 24 years in prison. I served 18. We were lucky. Some did not survive it. And there's a special kind of person who does something not for themselves, that steps up to the plate, I don't know how many of you have heard of the black revolutionary Ashada Shakur. Marilyn Buck busted her out of prison, and she's living safely in Cuba right now. Marilyn Buck is still in prison, and this was a long time ago. Ashada was in prison for shooting a New Jersey state, killing a New Jersey state trooper. For Marilyn to do that was what was an exceptional thing. Another exceptional example of that type of willingness is Mark. He busted a comrade out of police custody, shot a police officer in the process, and successfully freed a comrade from custody. Those are things that I admire in people. I'm going to talk for a little bit, and then we'll have questions. And so, if you have questions as I'm going along, just make a memo or a written note, and you can ask them when I'm done. I do prison work, and I passed out newsletters to most of you. Anybody that didn't get one, there's some here. No, I edit this. Prison work is a good area of work to do. And some people who are doing this kind of work are working around HIV or hepatitis C, others on gay issues, racist issues. But regardless of what level of work, now, also there's a lot of people like Marilyn Buck who are still in prison, political prisoners here in the United States, who need to be supported. And so, on the international level, there's three levels to this. There's international, there's national, and there's local. On the international level, the prisoners at Guantanamo are victims of torture, are victims. All this is being done in our name. And where is the outraged voice of the left that's taking place as this torture and these show trials are taking place. Jose Padilla was arrested on U.S. soil, held as an enemy combatant. He's a U.S. citizen, yet, you know, nobody had anything to do with that. Nobody, you know, there needs to be work done on the international level in terms of prison work. On the national level, working to save the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal is another priority. I imagine most of you have heard of Mumia and know what that case is. He shot a police officer in Philadelphia. And you'll hear a lot of, you know, we like people who shoot police. Can't help it. So there's national POWs like Mumia, like Marilyn Buck, and a number of others. And there's publications from, you know, the anarchist ABC groups and stuff like that that provide information on who these people are. And there's also a good book, Can't Jail the Spirit, that lists political prisoners in the United States. I think there's about 100 of them listed in that book. And so we need to support prisoners of that category, of that magnitude. And not only then, but also when they get out. When Mark was released, the community had raised, in Seattle, had raised $7,500 cash for him. They had secured a job for him at the Public Defender Agency, where he continues to work today, provided him with a car. And I can pretty much guarantee you that if we don't take care of the prisoners who have made those sacrifices in order to try and make this a better world, there's not going to be another generation of people who are willing to make those sacrifices. So it's, you know, if I'm passing on a message to anybody here, that would be the message, is that these people need to be defended and supported. And thirdly, on the local level, there's a tremendous opportunity for organizing prisoners and family members around issues such as conjugal visits or the right to vote. The Constitution says that everybody shall be enfranchised regardless of previous condition of servitude. Now, in so many states, including this one, ex-convicts can't vote. I mean, this is a cinch win. It's just never been presented. Any law students here? There's an excellent vehicle for a cinch win. We have a group of people here. There's 3.2 or 2.3 million, whichever, people who are disenfranchised and held in, under the 13th Amendment of the United States, held in a condition of slavery, which is sanctioned under the 13th Amendment. Slavery shall be abolished except for those convicted of a crime. These people are held in a condition of irresponsibility and dependency, and I got a puppy recently, and the first puppy I got was really well. I was in prison for 18 years, and I hadn't had one for 20 years before that. So anyway, long time. And if there's one thing I learned real quick, is that you motivate through rewards, not punishment. You can stick a prisoner in a cage and poke a broom handle in day in and day out, and when that prisoner gets out, he's going to be full of anger. He's going to be full of rage, and that rage is going to find expression. It's going to be on his wife, his children, his neighbors, the community. It's going to, you know, what is happening now is not functioning. It's not working. It's counterproductive. And people need to to work on that. The Middle East. In San Francisco, there's a progressive, worker-owned, cooperative co-op called Rainbow Grocery. And they recently, well, when I was down there, refused to sell products that came from Israel. The Zionist lobby was outraged. They were out there with signs and picketing and just, you know, how dare they? How dare they do such a thing? So in my years of practice, I found a couple of little rules or, you know, guidelines to help me. You know, there's a lot of distractions along the way. You know, this hot dog stand is over here, and next thing you know, you're a liberal. And one of these little life's lessons is that if you're not making enemies, you're doing something wrong. The workers at Rainbow Grocery were making enemies. And the point is that there's many levels of struggle. None are better than others. And the divestment movement against the Zionists is just one of them. There may be some argument, but in my opinion, Judaism is a religion. At most, it can be an ethnicity, like Gypsies. But Palestine belongs to the Palestinians. In terms of Iraq, most of the left has taken sides. We're all firmly against the occupation. But what are we doing to support the Iraqi resistance? What are we... revolutionary defeatism is a back in 1904, Japan was at war with Russia. Both Japan and Russia were imperialist countries. They were small baby sister imperialist countries compared to Britain and Germany and England and the like. And the left in Russia, not only the left, but even the cadets, the liberals, all adopted a line of revolutionary defeatism. In other words, that defeating our own ruling class would encourage revolution. And that proved true in the 1905 revolution, or attempted revolution. And similar attitude, we need to advocate for the defeat of U.S. imperialism. We need to do more than that. We need to take sides, and that's what's not happening. Well, I'm not going to side with those Islamo-fascists who suppress women's rights and anti-communist and anti-gay. And in so doing, you put issues like you put such issues ahead of those of class. And the anti-imperial, the global, international, global class struggle, and that should be the fundamental basis. The fundamental thing is that the people of Iraq have an absolute right to their own resources and not to be occupied by a foreign invader. And whatever means they use. International law supports whatever means they use, no matter how much we here in the occupying nation disagree with those tactics. it is our obligation to support them. I'm like Rip Van Winkle. I went to prison for almost 20 years. I came out. The world was really different. When I went to prison, I thought things were so bad, I'd rather risk death or imprisonment rather than to continue to see these things be as bad as they are. My only perceptions of reality on the outside were from watching television. I come out 20 years later, and things are way, way, way worse. People are sleeping in the streets. You can't even say hello to a child walking down the street. Fear permeates everybody, everything. It's and yet nobody's talking about that elephant that's standing in the front room. I mean, it's just blows me away. So, one of the things that we struggled with a lot back in the day, as we call it, was racism and sexism. And we came from the position that if you're a male raised in this culture, you're a sexist. If you're a white person raised in this culture, you're a racist. And once addressing those issues, then you can take the steps necessary to bring about change. And it will take, even after a revolution, it'll take generations to erase the negative and destructive effects of bourgeois culture. How we attempted to deal with these issues in the brigade, at least in terms of the issue of sexism, was to divide our communities. And for men to look to each other for their emotional support and sexual expression. We use the term so as not to drain the energy of women that they need to build and gather strength. We use the term political faggot back then. Both. White leftists have betrayed the black movement at every step of the way. There's one group that didn't, and that was a offshoot of the Weather Underground, the May 22nd group. And they were involved in the students of this history, well, the Brinks robbery. They were good. And the reason being that every time push came to shove, every time things got hot, we could always just slink on back into our white skin privilege and leave them out to dry. As a result of this, few.
I want to speak about it,
okay.
When you get because that's
okay. And these are my opinions. As a result of this, few armed or revolutionary black groups trust white radicals, and I think that the only way to change this is for white revolutionaries to build fighting organizations that put themselves out and from there they can make the alliances. It's possible to build such groups and to move forward. But only if the twin evils of homophobia, well, sexism, and which is part of sexism, and are addressed. Okay, lastly, speaking of fear, a lot of people are, you know, when we started the brigade, there was a group of about 30 of us, and we were studying a book called Prairie Fire. And it preached against, it advocated against American exceptionalism. And so the group split into about three parts. One part went off and formed the brigade. But before that happened, when this kind of activity was talked about, everybody, we're infiltrated. We can't do that. We're infiltrated. The FBI is everywhere. I mean, you know, the fear. But you can't know what a pear like tastes like unless you bite into it. You can't know what level of struggle can be sustained unless you engage in it. Mark passed out some of these old ORCA that was printed by a group probably about a year after the brigade was active. And, well, anyway, some of us split off and went on to form the brigade. And, you know, how are we going to know we're infiltrated except by just doing it? And so we did it. So here's John Reed, the FBI agent in charge of hunting down the brigade. About a year after the brigade is active. He says, quote, "They are here, there, everywhere," unquote. Here's the police chief. Quote, "They could have a place way out in the boondocks. They might have a mile-long driveway with 100 yapping dogs. Or they could be that lovely couple who just moved in next door." And here's a quote from the Seattle PI. "The George Jackson Brigade has made nearly as many appearances in this area as Mount Rainier in the past 2 years." They did not have a clue. And if we had allowed the fear, if we had allowed fear to immobilize us, then the government would have done its job just fine. And Mark?
Yep. Well, just back up a little bit. Okay. You know, we have our own rest. I'm separating the black community from the rest of the United States community, just for a second. We have a history that we struggle with. And we have our own rascals. They call it leadership. Just like anybody else has their rascals. Okay, Bush is a rascal. Now, Obama being in, he's a rascal. We don't expect everything from him. But we know our history. We know that we weren't allowed to have a rascal. We weren't allowed to vote for a rascal for a long time. We got the right to vote. And after 40 years, we finally voted our own rascal in with the help of others. I understand that. While I was in the Panther Party, we had one of our founders was Huey Newton. He became a rascal himself within the party. In other words, by calling him a rascal means he wasn't doing everything right, and we knew it. But he was our leadership, and he was our rascal. And in a sense, I became kind of a methodical rascal for some of the people in the black community. They look up to me for what I did, but they know I didn't do everything the way they wanted me to do it. So I was their rascal. I have to understand history this way. There is no perfect, what you call a founding father, founding mother of any kind of movement. We respect them. I respect Asada. I respect Leonard Peltier, Sundiata Okoli, Jan Lahman. But we have to understand that they are not perfect. None of us are perfect. We try and form a model so we can work together, the best model we can get. We generally start with a small model. You know, like the brigade, that was a small model. They could work together. More women there than there were men. In the Panther Party, two-thirds of the people, party members, were women, not men. But you, all you read about are the men in the black berets and carrying the rifles. You don't know about the women who are carrying those guns. So the police would shake down the men, they wouldn't have no guns, but the women were carrying those guns. They're carrying them in big purses. But they were the ones that formed the food breakfast program for the kids. They were the ones that did a lot of the programs. They're the founders, they're the body of the program, but they didn't get all that credit. Obama is in there, and I know, nobody has to tell me, I know majority of the people that put Obama in there were women. There's no doubt in my mind. I'm working with two organizations right now, and the majority of the people in are women. We sit up here, you know, kind of a macho thing, and it has to be sexist on kind of the parts of the people who asked it to come and the people who are looking. You look to us as a leadership, but you don't understand who was around us, who surrounded us. When John Truman was broken from custody, the majority of the people there were women, not just me. There were women there driving those cars and carrying guns. But you never hear about them. They're not in the papers. You have to really look at the perspective. When I'm in the Panther Party, when I joined the Panther Party, I joined it because I was concerned about the conditions of the community that I lived in and that my family lived in. When I hooked up with the brigade, I was concerned about conditions, and they did their actions in support of community programs, community things that were going on, whether it's the union, whether it's oppression in the prison, but it was something community, something that I could identify with. Sure, it's great to have opinions about, you know, foreign policy, what's going on in the world. Sure, we understand that. But our greatest concern is what's happening to us right now. And if you're talking about our economy kind of falling apart right now, that's a community thing. It's global. But we're concerned with what's happening here right now. You know, when I speak, I generally speak to other black groups. The majority of people in those groups are black when I do speak. And it's kind of strange for me speaking now, trying to relate to you what your responsibilities and duties are to your community. You got to have to find a model. You sit here and look at us, and we can't give it to you. We can give you some ideas. We can give you some philosophies, some principles. That's what I live by. I spent 40 years in prison. And one of the things I really am proud about being in prison is that I was able to form principles from the very first, and I locked them in. I was tortured. I don't believe in torture. I don't believe in torturing anybody because I was tortured. I was strapped down. I was stretched. And I'd get beaten. And I had my share of tear gas. And so has it. Now, torture isn't even on the table as far as I'm concerned, especially here in the community. If we can't do it to ourselves, we shouldn't be able to do it to anybody else. Because we are brothers and sisters to everybody in the world. The perspective that I come from with all of my activism really is about the community I live in, and the community I live in a sense, our borders are the United States. Now, I'm not saying I'm a nationalist. I'm not saying I'm just trying to confine myself. I understand what's going on outside, but I don't have more than two hands, and I'm getting on in age. Pretty soon, I'll be old. I mean, you know, I got great-grandchildren right now, and when I get old, I'm going to have great-great-grandchildren. I'd like to be dead before that happens, but it doesn't look like it's going. And when I'm looking at you, I'm looking at you. You have the age of my grandchildren right now. You feel like you're adults. You are adults. You're grown. But from my eyes, I see you just like my grandchildren. They're your age. Some are in college. And I'd like to probably give you some kind of insight, some kind of impetus to do some kind of good in the world, relate to each other as brothers and sisters. You know, you're gonna have, you know, you got problems. You can look around the room and you know some people that you just would like to poke with a stick, but and you know people here you'd like to really get to know. But this is a community here in this school. This is community. I was in Walla Walla and I met five other guys. I think three more Canadians, and had an idea of making Walla Walla a better place. So we set up an underground, just six of us, printed a newspaper called A Bomb. It was an underground newspaper. Nobody knew we was doing it but us. But the people who read it, the prisoners and the administration, they read it, and they knew that something was happening. And we were able, in a sense, to control that prison in such a way that we did make it a better place. In fact, we probably were the only people in the history of the United States who were able to take over a prison and hold up for 2 years, and the people didn't even know we had it. it was an empty building. It was a women's quarters. They shipped everybody to Purdy up here, all the women to Purdy up here, and they left an empty building down there. And we said, we wanted that building, we wanted to put a shop in there. And got funding and convinced them to let us do it. It was six prisoners. But we brought in other prisoners, and we set up the model that they would live by, or they couldn't get in the program. We'd censor ourselves. No drugs, no alcohol, no violence, and no apathy. That was all we asked them. If they violated any one of those things, they were out of the program. And everybody in the institution wanted to get in the program, but there was no room for everybody. But what happened is we were given that. It worked like we said it was going to work. Again, we became the highest paid prisoners in the United States at that time, just for 2 years. We had that building for 2 years. They didn't know we actually took it over. They thought it was their program. But it doesn't take a huge group. You know, a mass movement has a great deal to do with leadership. And you got to be careful. Don't never give your leadership full rein, because they're rascals. We are rascals. And the things we were doing, we wrote a constitution for them. The first one we wrote, we said, you know, this is a weak constitution. You guys ought to burn it up. This is in the underground newspaper. We said this. And so the guys took it, and they burned it up. And so we wrote another one, a better one, the one that we actually wanted. And they accepted it. And like I said, we were rascals. They didn't know who we were or what we were doing. It looked like two different people here. The people who were writing the Constitution and the people running the underground newspaper. That we're all the same people, just six people. And we got away with something for a long time. And that's when I really got politicized, when I really understood what you could do with you know, political action, political control. I never really got to get that far when I got out, but I wanted to do that. When I got to Seattle, the Panther Party had pretty much dissolved. I had to bring with me what I could out of Walla Walla. There's very few people. And when I went into the brigade, I was the only one of the Panther Party that went into the brigade. But I still had my ideas based on the 10-point program of the Panther Party, that it was be focused on the community, and most everything, every action that the brigade took had to do with community, whether they knew it or not. Then the communiques went out and they talked about a lot of things going on, but it generally pointed to what was happening in the community. And I just wanted to kind of clear that up. But like the main thing I wanted to get to is that, you know, we understand that Barack will not do everything. He's a politician. He's going to do what the establishment wants. He's going to have some control. He's a rascal, but he's our rascal this time.
Let me say just one thing, and then we can throw this open to questions. There was an old communist back in 1905 named Plekhanov, who wrote a book called The Role of the Individual in History. And his premise was that there are times when small groups and individuals can have a huge impact on political realities. An example might be Fidel Castro, who, with just a tiny handful of people, or Ho Chi Minh, who had 9 propaganda officers and himself, and successfully threw out the French imperialists and the U.S. imperialists from his nation. So there are times in history when small groups and individuals can accomplish a huge amount. There are other times in history when, for example, back in the 1950s, when no matter how much you beat your head against that brick wall, nothing is going to move. And so recognizing, you know, when times are when is, but like Mark says, a small group of people did what they did at Walla Walla. When I was at Walla Walla, we created an organization called, six of us, created an organization called Men Against Sexism that stopped the buying and selling of prisoners by other prisoners and the prisoner-on-prisoner rape at that facility. Well, so small groups can, you know, people are not powerless. Just takes, you know,
and a model. That's the main thing. Make something that, you know, you can all agree to. You know, whether it's above ground or underground, just make something you all agree to. Make, that's called a model.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's time to hear questions. I seen some hands going up earlier, and it went down. Yeah.
What's the name of the program that you started in Walla Walla Prison?
Okay. There's two programs. The first one was called the Family Group. That was inside the prison itself. And we convinced the warden to give us what's called a tier in there, 16 cells long, to set up our program. That was the first one. We were running a upholstery shop with Prison Industries. Reupholstery, you know, furniture, that was the project that we were working on. And then we wrote a grant. These are prisoners. We wrote a grant and got $125,000 and kind of upset the prison. But we wanted the women's quarters, the abandoned women's quarters outside, and that was called the Bridge Project, Inc. And that's when we moved us out there and we ran that program. By the way, in 2 years, when it shut down, I came down from Seattle with some other people and bought everything they had and brought it back to Seattle. We created what we call a Pivot Project, and we had a reupholstery, interior design, micrographics. The microfilming they have in King County Courthouse in Seattle, we did all that. Yeah, it was one of our projects. But anyways, we kind of used that same model we had down there and brought it up here and used ex-cons and some people in halfway houses to run this program. Yeah.
And that action was done in support of Walla Walla prisoners who were being brutalized in the segregation unit. So I was, because I had a lot of respect for the prisoners, I was locked up. As I was being processed into the segregation unit, there was another kid coming in, being booked also. I didn't know him, never seen him before. He was about 20. And they put him in cell 10 and me in cell 11. He was in the next cell. And that night, a group of prisoners, a gang of prisoners, with the help of a guard who was running the, who was down at the end of the tier, trying to open this kid's cell so this other gang could get in and rape this kid. And the kid would put a book, a hardbound book, in the bars to keep it from opening, to keep the door from opening. And the guy, the rapo gang, the leader of which was an ex-professional boxer who was in the segregation unit for killing somebody, that whole group they would try and grab the book, and the kid would grab it, and the guard would try to open the door. And I was this was my first night in prison, and I was afraid, I was scared, and I wanted to yell, you know, stop, you villains, but I was afraid that they would come and come after me, and so they couldn't get the door open that way, and so they tried throwing hot water from the sink down at the end of the tier on. And that didn't work. The guards tired of it. There were huge struggles going on in segregation from time to time. A love-hate relationship between the prisoners and the guards. Sometimes they would be throwing fecal matter and urine on the guards. And the guards didn't like this. And so they liked to maintain peace. And so that's why they did this. Anyway, the next day I tried to find out, you know, what's up with this? And I talked to prisoners on the tier. What's happening here? Oh, this is the way it is. This is, and it was. The way you established yourself in the pecking order inside the prison was by raping weaker and more vulnerable prisoners. And it was just, I mean, that was, every prison has some mechanism for putting you, you know, in Brushy Mountain Prison in Tennessee, the tough guys ran poker games. And the really tough guys robbed the poker games. Well, I mean, it just, you know, that's the way it was. And so a long struggle took place, and ultimately six of us, the Walla Walla brothers, were released from the segregation unit. And we formed this group called Men Against Sexism to combat prisoner-on-prisoner rape. We had, if you take a piece of 3/8 inch pipe and a piece of 7/8 inch pipe, put a nipple or a cap on the end of the larger pipe, drill a little hole in it and put a sheet metal screw in there, a 410 shotgun shell that can be keister stashed and smuggled in from the fitting room fits into the smaller pipe just fine. And then you take and slide that like that, and you have a homemade shotgun. And so we had six homemade shotguns. And that's how, that's one of the mechanisms by which. But we also published a newsletter. We screened films such as Men and Masculinity. We did a lot of, in other words, multi-level approach to this problem. And that's what we did.
Questions, opinions?
How did the shotgun shell, how did you get shotgun shells into the prison in the first place?
In the butt. Visitors bring them in.
Yeah, some things you don't want to know are how the pistols got in there, how the hand grenades are made, etc. So, you know, every prison is different. He's talking about tough guys. I brought to mind in Leavenworth, we had to say all the tough guys are dead, because if you say you were a tough guy, that gives you ground for somebody to kill you. And they had psychopaths in Leavenworth who was just looking for a target. I mean, if they could find a child molester or something like that, they'd go after him. But when somebody called himself a tough guy, those psychopaths would go after him. So all the tough guys were dead. That was a saying they had in Leavenworth. So never say you was a tough guy.
Having shotguns and made shotguns and publishing the newsletter actually helped you alleviate the situation?
Well, we had same cells. First of all, there were about about 30 of us. And so there's a young child molester come in. There's the child molester who wears the trench coat and stands out in front of the school with the candy. And then there's a kid who's kind of emotionally not developed right and who's doing child care at a community child care center in the Paragosa community. And he and another boy are engaged in mutual masturbation. So he goes to prison. And as soon as he comes in, he's glommed onto by one of these tough wazee. And so we have to intervene and get him out of that situation and get him into a safe cell. And they're confronting us, you know, what the fuck are you doing standing up for the stinking child molester? And you know, you always have to be able to back up what you're. Mao said it best: political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. So that's why.
But I mean, it seems to me like the two types within each other need to be recognizable, so you have to actually require it in order to make a statement.
No. The same way. The same way as MAD, mutual assured deterrent between the United States, is all you have to do is have it, and you most likely won't have to use it. We only had to fire it once, and it was at a side of beef. So.
Yeah, I'm going to essay yours, which you talked about your experience with the George X Brigade. And, you said that although you definitely were glad that you erred on the side of revolution, that's all a person can do, and you went after something that you really believed, and you weren't sure that was, at that point in time, the right action. The idea was in pacifism, the mythology, more Churchill killed your own intro. And maybe that wasn't exactly what you were saying, but at the same time, really making me think, like you were talking about, you know what the action will be when you get to that point. Like in a certain period, like when people will know that there needs to be action taken. But at the same time, I mean, you're talking about we're being the age of your grandkids in terrible conditions in prison. And like with the Patriot Act, especially in the continuance of the Golden War on Terrorism, anybody who even, you know, you're seeing people thrown in military prisons who maybe, you know, said once or twice to somebody in the FBI that they, you know, thought about maybe sending money to the Middle East. And it's like, yes, I know we have to find our own criteria, but like, does it have to be all or nothing? Or what's, like, when you're talking about, like, violence, insurrection, and just doing your part to either protect your community or create this type of revolution you're talking about, what do you think? I mean, it just seems like such a difficult question. How did you come to the point that you really could be comfortable in the fact that you were going to take violent action? And how do you reconcile that with conditions today?
Well, that's a tough one.
Well, I can answer just in part. When I shot that cop, I didn't go there with the intention of shooting the cop. I went there with the intention of freeing the prisoner. I thought there were, you know, the gun was just going to be intimidation enough. But I thought he was going for his gun, and I just shot it before he could get to it. The brigade armed actions were against property, not against people. They made that one of their themes. There was Bruce Seidel, he was killed in a gunfight. This was something, the timing was wrong. Nobody's supposed to get killed. And of course, the thing where somebody was captured and I would broke them out, that was something that wasn't supposed to happen. The actions were supposed to be against property and to do expropriations without people getting hurt. But they planned so well that nobody's supposed to get hurt. But things, the best laid plans of mice and men, etc., blah, blah. I was just answering it in part, that we don't intend to attack people. But we never intended. This is something in the past. That was in part. It was understood among all brigade members not to harm somebody. When they stole a car once, they returned the car to the person with an apology card. Who was that? Remember that? Yeah. With an apology that we had to take your car to do this robbery, blah, blah, blah.
Our model was taken from something that Mao Zedong said, and that's not to harm or take a single threat belonging to the people. And so that's what we were. We did not want those. Now, you know, the state's apparatus of repression, that's, you know, in our opinion, was a different. We had to defend ourselves.
Mark, you were talking about how you are using political maneuvering inside the prison to control or manipulate the system.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about how you perceive an effective relationship between such politicizations and more direct or violent action against
within prison?
Within prison or outside of prison.
Are you talking about how we did as that group? Okay. Yeah. We used an underground newspaper. That was our real weapon. We call it the bomb. And it was strong because of the propaganda value within, and also that we were getting away with it because they started shutting down all the printing machines trying to stop us. It was called a mimeograph type of a paper. They shut down the mimeograph machines. They, you know, locked up the mimeograph fluid trying to stop the paper. They couldn't stop it because we weren't using that method. We were using another method. So there was two things there. It was kind of a Robin Hood type thing that all the prisoners understood. They could identify with what we were doing. We're helping them exposing corruption within the prison, you know, through this little paper. And that was stronger than actually using violence. And it worked. It just worked. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what they can do.
In The Power of the People is the Force of Life, the brigade talks about the police as a backwards element, mentioning that they were drawn from working class backgrounds. The majority of their work was grunt work, and they were still working class, even though they were backwards in that they were essentially fighting the working class and keeping down the working class. Christian Williams in his book has like an alternate analysis talking about how now police, once they're police, they're always police, whether they're on duty or not, and how police don't collectively bargain the same way as the rest of the working class against their employers, how police and the people with hiring and firing power collectively bargain together against the government, all for better wages. So there's not a fight against there's no tension between employer and employee in that way. Do you still think of the police as part of the working class, or do you think of them as a separate class?
I've always considered the police the enemy, but the person who wrote that, John Sherman. We organized the Washington State Prisoners Labor Union at Monroe Prison. 97% of the prisoners were card-carrying union members. John Sherman wanted us to meet, wanted he and I to go meet with the union, go to a union meeting of the guards union, and to tell them that we're all workers and we can all be, a lot and happy. And so I said, okay, I'll go with you, but it's crazy. So that was his opinion.
Okay.
Did it work?
No, they were amazed that we would have the nerve. If there's no more, then we should go ahead and close this out. I would like to say one thing, two things, quickly. And that is, if you want to study, you need to know how to think, not what to think. And a good study group for people to form is on dialectical and historical materialism. And secondly, speaking of all those prisoners, political prisoners who are still inside, they're going to be coming out. They are coming out as we are. And think about the need for a Red Star retirement home for these folks. And with that, we'll close this off for this evening. Thank you for coming. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.